being a banker for 21 years almost.
That's okay. It's going to fuel you. It's still, I think, fueling me to this day.
Somebody that's a little bit bored should be waiting a long time. So people are just going to have to roll up their sleeves.
Try to make sense of it because there's so much information coming in and you don't know what's relevant and what's not.
The corporate world for 4 years as a CEO.
I'm not interested in having this small probability of losing a whole lot of money.
You need to be surrounded by other smart people.
Got me through the door because it's a pretty small group and it's
Hello, everyone. This is your host, Maura Maya. Welcome to another episode of the Finance Podcast, where I explore the professional journey of individuals who have successfully built careers in the financial industry. This episode is particularly interesting as we will be talking about COVID-19 and its effect on markets and how this will all play out. My guest this week is Roy Cabla. Mr. Cabla is Managing Director and Co-Head of Houlihan Lokey's Technology, Media, and Telecom Group, co-leading a team responsible for driving the firm's corporate finance effort in the sector. He has experience across a broad range of investment banking solutions and has been involved in over $200 billion of M&A and capital structure assignments in the media, entertainment, and communications industry. Mr. Cabla is based in the firm's New York office. His clients have been major corporations and financial investors in North America, Europe, and Asia across a variety of sectors, including advertising, cable TV, broadband, cinema, content, digital media, fiber, information services, marketing services, music, OTT video, out-of-home entertainment, publishing, satellite communications, sports, talent agencies, television, wireless, and wireline. Prior to joining Houlihan Lokey in 2018, Mr. Cabla was Global Head of Media and Telecoms at Nomura, one of Asia's leading investment banks and a member of its Global Investment Banking Executive Committee. He joined Nomura in 2010 in New York and held a variety of leadership roles across its global TMT practice. Previously, he spent a decade at Lehman and then, following Lehman Brothers Inc.'s sale, Barclays. He established its leading U.S. out-of-home entertainment franchise with over $10 billion of mergers, acquisitions, restructurings, and committed financing 18 months following the 2008 financial crisis. Mr. Cabla started his career with TD Securities in Toronto, focused on Canadian TMT. Mr. Cabla earned a Bachelor of Commerce from McGill University with great distinction. He is a member of the French-American Foundation's Transatlantic Forum and McGill University Des Hôtels Global Experts Program. In addition, Mr. Cabla acts as an independent board member of certain private companies. So please enjoy my conversation with Roy Cabla. Hi, Roy. Thank you for being on the platform here today. A pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me. Great to see you.
So the first question I want to ask is, before we get into understanding your day-to-day role as a managing director for Houlihan Lokey, is to understand how your story starts. How does it all begin?
It's a great question. It starts in a bit of an unusual way. As you may be able to tell from my voice, I'm actually French. And so growing up as a teenager in school, I was reading a lot of French newspapers about the economy and financial markets. And at the time, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have real-time information. And I was really curious as to why currencies would move the way they move, you know, why the stock market would move the way it moves. And that's really what kind of drew me into this. And I remember at the time that I started reading books when I was in Europe, and it seemed that a lot of the innovation in the financial services industry was actually happening on the other side of the Atlantic. A lot in America, obviously. So pretty quickly it was like, okay, how do I get to do this? What's the fastest way forward and path? And actually that's what kind of drew me to go to McGill. There was a nice Quebec and French connection. And then from there, I start to do what all the students do, which is, okay, you know, find the class that makes the most sense, try to get a job, summer internship, and so on and so forth. And I basically executed on the plan and, you know, got the first job at the school at TD in Toronto, you know, worked there, for a little bit as a foreign student. You know, you still have these programs, I think, where you can stay in Canada for a year. And then I moved to the city in London and off it went.
Great, fantastic story. And I want to move more into what you're doing on a day-to-day. And what are some of the biggest challenges you've encountered and how do you overcome them in your career?
Oh, it's a complicated question in the sense that, you know, every day is a little bit different. There's some things that you recognize on the job that are very similar. You've dealt with them before. But at the end of the day, the banking business, the M&A business is really a people business. And, you know, people come to you with issues and problems and challenges. And every client's got a different situation. Every client's got a different problem. And you try to come up with what makes the most sense. But the one thing that I've learned over the years is that you got to be in this job a really good listener. There's no copy and paste type solution. There's some efficiencies that comes with experience. You know what to look for. You know what the pressure points might be. But a big part of the job is in, okay, what is actually the client looking for? That's really the key. And if you want to be adding value in what is effectively a relationship business, it's the number one thing to pay attention to.
Changing the question just a little bit, I want to ask, what are some of the most important decisions you've made throughout your career, whether it be a transition, anything in that aspect?
So it's also an interesting question because you don't know that it was a turning point until you've made the decision and you look back, actually. And in my career, I've you know, in many ways, I've worked with a lot of the same people over the years building my network, but I've had a lot of changes. You know, I like I said, I started in Toronto for working for a Canadian investment bank, and then I had to go to London. And then I stayed there for 4 years, and I worked with other folks, and I got an opportunity to go to New York. And every time it was driven by the people that I had met, the opportunities. And I would say that every decision was actually pretty pivotal in my career because they all led to basically where I went next. And I think if there's one lesson that I learned in all of this, it's really about, you know, the opportunities that you have in front of you. There's nothing that's predefined. It's a lot about what you make of them. It's also a lot about the people you meet on the way. And one of the key lessons I learned going through all this for the last two decades really was that, you know, some of it has to do with doing your homework. Some of it is, you know, luck or fate, depending on what you want to call it, and the people that you meet. And one of the very important things in somebody's career is to make sure that you work actually with good people, people that are going to train you, invest in you, and give you good opportunities. And I was very fortunate in that regard. You know, along the way, I got trained by people that were incredibly successful, very smart, and were generous enough with their time with me to learn the tricks of the trade. So, you know, from London, I went to New York with Lehman Brothers. I was there through the bankruptcy. You know, we got acquired, quote unquote, by Barclays in the United States back in 2008, when the firm gets split up between the US business and the non-US business. You know, some of my old colleagues at Lehman in Europe and Asia had been sent back in 2010 to build the Nomura investment banking business. And I was given an opportunity to join that platform to build it up from scratch, really, on the investment banking side. And that was another exciting opportunity. And all of this was driven by people. And all of this was driven by relationships, situations where, you know, I was given an opportunity. And those were all pretty pivotal moments that led from one thing to the other.
I do want to continue with just something you mentioned about moving to Barclays when Lehman got acquired and was in the 2000, it was 2008. I want to ask, for a lot of students, this is an interesting time. We've experienced a very rapid recession and very rapid recovery as well. And a lot of these students are graduating in 2020 and 2021. And it's an interesting time to start joining the labor market. What is the best advice you can give to students entering this crunch period, I guess you could call it?
Yes, I'm sure it must feel pretty challenging. And it is. Don't get me wrong. I think in some ways, the crisis we're going through right now is worse than Lehman. And I remember at the time I said there couldn't be anything worse. But but also it's been compressed on a different timetable. You know, what we want between March and the summer this year feels like what we went through between October 8 and March 2010, in terms of what's happened with the government and market intervention and just stakeholders taking action to make sure that this crisis doesn't get worse. The I think going back to your point though, the negative is it's a tough time to break in, right? You don't have as many opportunities. And you need even more in this environment to do all the things that come with networking, building relationships, and making sure people understand you're different. And a lot of that comes down to actually really building relationship. Look, everything, if there's anything I've learned is like business is all about building good relationship and people understand your value add. Okay, so that's even more critical now than in normal times. But at the same time, I would say this. When I look back, really the best entry points are at times of crisis. You know, whether it's business, a career, or a job opportunity, the people that I've seen doing their best work, making the most of opportunities, decided to take a risk at a time where people were saying, like, I'm not trying to take too much risk right now, right? It was true in 08, 09. It was true around after the internet crash. I remember, you know, thinking about the job market and opportunity to get a job on Wall Street back in 98, you know, because I was class of 99. And so that was, can't remember if it was the Asian or Russian crisis, but it wasn't a great time either. And actually it's during these inflection points that, you know, if you can find an opportunity, you're going to have the best curve ahead of you. And it's pretty logical, actually. It's because if you think about, you know, the people businesses, investment banking, consulting, you know, you name them. If you're part of a recruiting class that is small because of the economy at that point in time, eventually the economy always comes back, right? It just does. And then if you're part of a small group of hires, then you're going to aggregate a lot of training and attention and knowledge from the organization, right? Versus being a much larger group. And so that's how you kind of make the most of things if you can crack in.
Great. Thank you. That's some great advice for some of our future graduates in the next 1 to 2 years. And a more basic question in terms of what you do on a day-to-day, what does a day in investment banking look like?
It's interesting. So I had this kind of misconception, you know, when I was at McGill about what the job was, which in my mind was a lot about doing big deals, executing, and you know, basically not spending too much time thinking about the business development aspect of it, the marketing aspect of it, the relationship building aspect of it, and when you're a banker, the reality is you do quite a bit of both. There's a big aspect of basically spending a lot of time with your clients and understanding what's on their mind. And then, you know, eventually, you know, having the opportunity to advise them, right? In my mind, the best bankers are the ones that are sort of like the family doctors. You know, you want to be the guy who's going to get the call on the weekend because there's some need for some help for something, right? You want to be the guy that has earned the trust of the client. And it's actually quite interesting. I will tell you, over the last 20 years, a lot of these people that I've worked with, because I've been following the same industry, have actually kind of become friends. And so you don't know actually where the line is between, okay, is this a business relationship? Is this a personal relationship? You know, and you know, this is in many ways, there is a personal aspect to this business. You give advice on events that are pretty critical to clients and their decision making and their business. So you spend a lot of time thinking about, okay, strategy, spend a lot of time thinking about the markets and what it means for your clients. And then you spend equal time, you know, coming up with a strategic plan. It may involve capital markets. It may involve M&A, it may involve all kinds of things, but it's having a really holistic view of what the right answer is. The things that I think I was probably very focused on when I was a student or a junior banker was all the financial technology aspect of the job. You know, merging two companies, is it better with a stock deal or a cash deal? Why? How do you make it happen? And it's true that it's really important and you cannot do the job without it. But I think the reality is that as there's more information out there and as the industry has grown, the part about what financial technology, what is the right financial technology for a client, you know, people sort of know. People have become very sophisticated. This is not the 80s or the early 90s where there was a lot of financial innovation. Innovation has come down in this industry. It's a lot more about everybody's got the information or a lot of the information. It's a lot about trusted advice and judgment call. And there's another aspect, obviously, of what I do, which over the years has become perhaps even not more important, but, you know, carries a lot of weight, which is, you know, helping people grow in their jobs, managing teams, and actually, you know, running a small business. You know, at Holy Hand Loki, we've got 60, 65 people doing TMT. You know, it's a lot of people you got to think about and making sure that they do the best they can and that they can perform, and you give them the tools and hopefully the conditions for them to be successful. And if they're successful in their day-to-day jobs, then hopefully the group is successful. So, you know, that's why, you know, at least as far as I'm concerned, there's not a single day that's kind of the same as the one before. And that's actually a good thing.
Yes, keeps things interesting. I do want to segue a little bit and ask a question. How does all of this team aspect work when you're working remotely? How has that adapted in this environment?
It was a real challenge. And you know, I don't know how sustainable this work from home thing is going to be long term, because a big part of the job is learning with people, having people around you. You know, I remember when I started my career at TD, I was a first year analyst, and we were, the team was basically three senior bankers, three associates, and I was the only analyst on the team pretty much. And we were like in this cubicle of like four of us, me and the three associates, we're great friends, by the way, today. And, you know, initially I was like, wow, that feels rough. I'm going to be the most junior person and I'm going to be basically kind of doing everything for everybody. And actually it turned out to be one of the best things that happened to me to learn, because I would sit with these people every day, long hours, and I'd see how they do their work. They'd teach me on the spot all the time. And you know, my job really was to learn as fast as I could, as much as I could. And so in a work from home environment, that's harder. I think we've been lucky at Holy Hand Loki because we're a pretty decentralized organization. We've got a lot of offices around the country and the world. We've been very flexible letting people work remotely over the years. There's a good technology platform to do that. So it was a bit more in the DNA, I would say, than maybe at some other firms that I've been at. But, you know, not being in the office means that you get to spend a lot of time communicating. You know, I spend a lot of time reaching out to people, checking on them, making sure they're busy, not for the sake of them being busy, work busy and doing stuff that wouldn't be productive, making sure they're engaged. And a critical part of that is making sure you've got a really two-way transparent form of communication. Tell the good, tell the bad, say how the business is going. Also ask people for their input. You know, one thing I've learned coming to North America, you know, from France, was that, you know, good input can come from anywhere. You know, it wasn't really the culture where I came from. You had to listen a lot. But it's true that great input can come from anywhere, especially in the sectors that we spend time in as a banker, technology, media, communication. I spent a lot of time asking questions on the team and saying, hey, what do you think? You guys know these companies and prospects better than I do at this point, and encouraging the dialogue, you know, to make sure that people stay engaged.
Hey, one last question on this topic. I think this is really interesting. It's going to help a lot of the students listening to the podcast. What is the best way for a student trying to get to know someone or trying to leave an impression and they can't meet in person, you can't go to your usual coffee chats? What's the best way they can connect and grow their network?
You know, well, I would say, you know, what you've done is a great example of it. You know, you created something that creates a link between the street community and your world, and there's some value add to it. So that's a great example of it. I'm not saying that everybody should be setting up a podcast and calling every street guy that they can find, but that's an example. And there are many examples of that you can do. You know, some folks, I know I've reached out to me, they write an investment newsletter. They don't have a portfolio to manage, but they come up with ideas. You know, not all of them are good, but you know, the less than a handful of guys that have good levers, you'd be surprised. People read, you know, because I think your generation has more tools in terms of following the markets than we did and can come up with a point of view that's probably more interesting than whatever we could do 20 years ago, thanks to that. You know, I've been doing not a class, but doing a semi-annual lecture at McGill with one of the professors, where the students present, and I think it you know, the quality of the presentation is really good. What I've been surprised by a little bit at McGill is actually students are not willing to engage as aggressively as probably elsewhere. You know, not a lot of people reach out and say, hey, here's what I do, here's why I think I'm different, can I get a bit of time from you and get your advice on this and that. You know, I would say what's different, especially in this environment from at Auburn schools, is that they're a lot more aggressive than what I see coming from McGill students.
This is some great insight. Thank you so much. I want to move into a different line of questioning, and it has to do with the current market environment. So we saw a correction yesterday. Is the tech bubble going to burst? We saw a small correction in equity markets driven by tech as investors moved away from the industry. Do you think this is the end of a correction of the buoyant tech prices, or is this something we're going to keep seeing in the next 12 to 18 months as markets become more volatile moving towards the American election?
So if I had a dollar every time I got that question, I think I'd be doing something else. I think as a general matter, and that is a topic that we've been discussing amongst ourselves, we've been of the view that the risk spectrum and focus areas are going to change post Labor Day. Politics, U.S. elections, some of the things that you've made references to. And the biggest issue in the markets is always whether that you don't know what is the second or third derivative, right? And so when it comes to politics, that's even harder to get a sense of. You know, a lot of people look at the technology rally and either say it makes complete sense or others say they don't understand it. I think you got to go back to fundamentals, right? You got to go back to the business models, the earnings power. And there's a good reason why these companies have been doing incredibly well. You know, I think it was Mike Milken who said one time that if you want to be a good financier, you have to be a good social scientist. And he's right. You know, why are the technology companies doing so well? It's because, well, guess what? Us as a society, you know, are dealing with these products and these tools in a different way. Your generation is going to be very different from mine when it comes to technology. And in some ways, you can argue it's almost the new utilities. You got to have them. Right. So that part in many ways is easy to understand, you know, in the sense that, you know, technology is not about a product cycle that may go obsolete. It's about, you know, what is this very stable business model that has a lot of visibility. The part that is hard to gauge, though, is everything that goes into how one measures risk and appropriate returns because of the macro. And I think the biggest unknown right now is how you think about the interest rate outlook. If you feel that you are in a new normal and the rates are going to stay the way they are right now, then you know what? Multiples are going to stay reasonably elevated for some time. And if you have a steady earning stream like the tech companies, then you're going to stay at a high multiple. If for whatever reason you think that, you know, at some point there'll be a rate reset, one way or the other, then that could be pretty dramatic in terms of what it means for equity valuations, right? And the problem, right, the main drivers of this, because the impact of the central banks and market in terms of providing liquidity is so huge. I don't know what would happen to that supply-demand, you know, relationship if you didn't have all that liquidity supposed to wait. And I don't think there's anybody on the street that's got, frankly, a clear roadmap of that particular issue. So until then, I think you're going to continue to see what we've seen for the many months, which is, you know, periods of volatility, like we started to experience yesterday, where people reset and take money at the table and say it's too much. And then followed by, you know, a bit of volatility, but no clear direction. And then if there's no catalyst to downside, people got to allocate money, you know, to asset classes, and they go back to what they think works. And I think we're in that pattern until there's a change in the macro in terms of what happens with central banks.
Great. I think there's an argument to be said in terms of fundamentals for these technologies. I do want to get into this just a little bit because I've had a lot of questions as well from our audience that I want to know from you, because you've worked, you've managed a lot of M&A with tech. And the question is, in terms of fundamentals, we saw in Apple and Tesla when they did their stock split, you saw this increase in stock prices, and the fundamentals haven't changed. There's nothing there. And there's also this argument that there's a very high turnover in tech, right? It's 5 to 10 years, you're going to be at the average leading firm. A decade ago, it was Cisco and IBM, and it's a very concentrated industry. So a lot of individuals are asking, is investing in something like Apple, it's steady, it's well capitalized, well managed, it's an established name, but are these prices worth buying into?
Well, I think the question you're asking is, are you getting paid for the risk, mm-hmm. effectively? And again, I don't think there's any right or wrong. I would say personally, I like the Warren Buffett point of, you got to invest in things you understand. These businesses that become ecosystems of pretty complex relationships. So, you know, you can decide that you're going to trust that ecosystem and you don't see anything changing, but that, and you could make a lot of money doing that. The people who have been doing that have been very successful.
Yes.
It doesn't mean though that you're pricing the risk appropriately. And that's one of the hardest part of finance, is when you think of a pricing risk. You know, one of the questions I often ask in an interview is, give me something you're bullish on, give me something you're bearish on. Can be an industry, an asset class, a stock, a bond, a currency, whatever you want. And often I get the answer why somebody loves or hates a stock typically. And usually, you know, let's speak of somebody in my industry. I love Netflix, and here's why. And it's all about they're making more shows, and it's all about they get that many subscribers. But there's not a lot about, you know, free cash flow. There's not a lot about, you know, risk. There's not a lot about, you know, interest rates. There's not a lot about cost of capital, those types of things. And if you ask me what I think it may not be getting a lot of attention right now is proper assessment of risk. But then again, you know, you may be right theoretically if the market and majority of investors are going one direction. This is all supply and demand, right? You know, there's the old saying, don't fight the Fed. And I think that speaks for itself.
Moving away from equities, I want to talk about investment banking in particular. What happens to M&A in an environment like the one we find ourselves in?
So this is also a great question in the sense that, you know, you were asking me, is there any kind of typical to investment banking? And I said, no. I think it's applicable also to kind of periods of what goes on the market. And what's been happening in the last 6 months is really unlike anything we've seen, or at least anything that I've seen personally. I've been doing this now 20 plus years. And, you know, when the crisis broke out sort of stateside late March, I think as a firm, we had a bit of a view that, okay, you know, the healthy M&A business is going to slow down. Large cap more quickly than the mid cap segment. And then restructuring work would pick up pretty quickly. And that's been true far and large. But I would tell you that two things have happened that has been surprising. It's been really surprising to us, to me. First off, the restructuring opportunity has been a bit slower than expected to pick up because of the Fed intervention in the market. So a lot of companies that you would think would not have access to the financing markets, you know, actually have had access to those markets and have an opportunity to see through the next 12, 18, 24 months. You know, a lot of companies in the that we spend time with in the out-of-home entertainment sector, you know, movie theaters, theme parks, you know, they've been able in many cases to tap the financing markets on reasonably okay terms at a time where we would have thought maybe back in March, how are these companies going to survive? And that's, by the way, to be clear, that's a great thing for the economy. So we'd rather see that than something else. At the same time, you know, we are seeing, you know, healthy pickup in M&A activity around the very the industries that have been reasonably stable through this crisis. So technology, definitely a lot of M&A happening, a lot of M&A conversations happening. Telecom services, broadband services, a lot of M&A activity happening there. And that's because if you just take those two segments as an example, you know, COVID or no COVID, these services are needed, right? And you have a dynamic where in particular the private equity industry still has a lot of capital to deploy, and they've been actively seeking these types of assets. So we have a lot of that in our business right now. And then if you look at the larger cap world, well, I think the reality is that a lot of the very big companies actually were reasonably well capitalized going into the crisis. You know, you have a lot of companies that were investment grade with large pockets of capital and access to liquidity. And many companies are dealing with technological changes, all the things that, you know, people love to talk about in the press. And those, a lot of these things are just true. And they are trying to take advantage of opportunity for M&A. The biggest hurdle that you see in the large cap M&A space right now is the volatility of the last 6 months and people needing to get comfortable as a buyer or as a seller, wherever now's the right time to transact or not from a valuation perspective. But the strategic imperative of pursuing some of these projects in the boardrooms, that is absolutely remains the case and intact, and those dialogues continue to be very, very active.
Thank you. There is just so many questions I want to ask, and we can have this conversation for hours, but I think it would be a great time to move into more of it. Questions for guidance for our audience. So I want to ask, to what skill and or value do you attribute most of your success?
Well, you're very kind first to say that, you know, quote unquote success, because you can't take anything ever for granted, and not just this business, but I think in life. So I think the people that do well, the people that are always take nothing for granted and a bit paranoid about doing better, because if you stop thinking about this, frankly, there's going to be somebody who's smarter, faster, more hungry than you that's just going to do it for you. So, you know, I think that's one aspect of it. Look, I think the other aspect of it is, I don't think I was the best at what I did over the years. I think a lot of people today that do are a lot better at this job than I probably am. And there are a lot of people who are more successful than I am. But I think the one thing that has been given me the opportunity to kind of progress over the years is one, take nothing for granted. Two, there's no substitute for hard work. And three, you got to be willing to learn and adapt and try new things. And you got to embrace risk. The part about being able to adapt is really important, because you always face new opportunities, new challenges, and new circumstances. And, you know, it being able to adapt is really critical. You know, you got to work hard. You got to stay hungry. You got to stay curious. You got to take nothing for granted. But being able to adapt to a new environment like we're in right now, ultimately, that is one of the very important skills that you need to be successful, I think.
Thank you. And another question, what are there any resources, perhaps books, which you would direct someone because they had some sort of impact on you, or you think it would has a very, very valuable information or lessons and whatnot?
Yeah. So I look, you know, most of the books I was reading as a teenager that got me into this kind of finance thing would not help because they were mostly booked by French journalists when I was in France talking about what was going on Wall Street just because of the financial innovation that was taking place at the time. So, but I would say if you had to pick a book for anybody who's interested in M&A, you know, Bruce Wasserstein, you know, Big Deal is always a classic. And it's a terrific book because here's an M&A banker who's a bit of a legend, frankly, who's been very successful in this in this industry, but at multiple industries, you know, working with clients from like all sides of the economy, and doing it brilliantly, understanding really the what I was referring to, which is okay, you know, what is the client's issue, what is the client's problem. And you have, it's very rare, but you do have a few people over the years that are able to do it from one industry to the other, get to know the industry, get to understand the client's problem, and come up with the right M&A answer. And so I think the Big Deal is a book that is pretty eye-opening about this ecosystem.
Amazing. Fantastic. Any closing remarks? Is there anything else you'd like to suggest or mention? Any advice to our audience as we wrap this up?
Look, I would say putting myself maybe in the shoes of the students and looking at COVID and thinking about, you know, how do you get a job and everything. You know, I'm sure it feels tough right now. Stay positive. Things turn around. Even when you feel there's no end in sight, you know, you don't know how, you know, the economy might recover. You don't know when the opportunities will come back. Stay positive. Things do turn around. Reach out, build relationships. You'd be surprised the number of times that it has felt this way.
Thank you for a fantastic conversation full of insight. It was a pleasure having you here.
Thank you. Stay well.
That was my conversation with Roy Cabla from Houlihan Lokey. I really hope you guys enjoyed it. It was an absolute pleasure having him on the platform. Remember that there's a lot more coming up and that this podcast is in collaboration with the McGill Investment Club. Stay safe and stay tuned.